many, many angels, and this is Jibra'il, and that is the Prophet of God, who is saying, my daughter, come to us, because what you have with us is better for you. Now, many people see something before they die. This happens to everybody. If you're a good person, you see a good person. If you're a bad person, you see something bad, something very, very scary. The angel of death approaches everyone in a particular way. If you have been good in your life, it will approach you looking like a young person, a beautiful young man, a young person. And if you have been bad in your life, you will see something horrific, which will scare you very much. Fatima is seeing angels and the Prophet, which shows us again her high status.
Yes.
She then closes her eyes for a few minutes and opens them and says, peace be upon you, O taker of souls, by God's order. Take my soul faster and do not make it difficult for me. So she's talking to the angel of death here. And then she says, I come to you, O God, and not to fire. She then closes her eyes, stretches her hands and stretches her legs and turns to the Qibla and she passes away. She passes to the next world. Asma was sitting beside her. She tore her clothes and she threw herself on Fatima's body. She continuously kissed her and told her, send my salams to the Prophet. It was at this moment that Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein entered. They said, Asma, our mother never sleeps at this time of day. Why is she sleeping? When Asma answered them, Imam Hassan threw himself on his mother's body and kept kissing her feet. And he said, oh mother, speak to me before my soul leaves my body. Imam Hussein went to her feet and was smelling her feet, because they say the smell of heaven comes from underneath the mother's feet.
Now remember that these are also very young children.
Yes, and they love their mother very much, as children do. It's a great tragedy to endure. And Imam Hussein, he kept smelling his mother's feet and said, oh mother, I am your son Hussein. Speak to me before my heart splits open and I die. Now Asma, she's crying, looking at these events that are taking place before her. And she tells them, go and tell your father of your mother's martyrdom. Now they left their house, but when they got near the mosque, their tears overtook them and their voices rose in sorrow and cries. A group of the Sahaba circled them and asked them, why are you crying? They answered and said, our mother has died. When Amir al-Mu'mineen heard this news, he fell to the ground and his face hit the ground. And he said, after this great tragedy, how will I calm my heart? How will my heart be calm? He picked himself up with great difficulty and took his children's hands and went home. On the way home, it is said that he tripped two more times and he picked himself up. This is Ali.
Out of grief.
Out of grief, yes. Mm-hmm. This is Ali. Fatah Khaybar, he picked up the door of Khaybar. It's not as if he didn't have the strength to walk properly.
Yes.
But out of grief, he kept tripping and picking himself up. He lost the woman who was dearest to him. He lost his companion, his friend, his supporter. When they reached home, they saw Asma crying next to Fatima's bed. When Imam Ali saw his beloved wife's body, he took off his turban and his abba. Abba is a cloak,
yes,
which in the Arab world men wear.
Mm-hmm.
And he sat down and cried very hard. Now, when the people of Medina found out about Fatima's death, cries overtook the city. And it was the same as it was when the Prophet passed. People came to give their condolences, and when they saw the tears of the grandchildren of the Prophet, they cried too. It became very crowded in the house of Imam Ali. People kept coming, going, giving their condolences. The Caliph at that time had the nerve to tell Imam Ali alayhi salam, do not pray on Fatima's grave before us. Let us be the first ones to pray on her grave. Because they missed out on praying on the Prophet's grave. Now, they weren't going to miss out on the chance on praying on Fatima's grave. Imam Ali did not answer them. And they said to each other, they thought this was because he was so sad he was unable to speak.
Right.
People started to gather. They wanted to bury her, attend her funeral. Amir al-Mu'mineen told Abu Dharr to tell the people that it is not possible to escort Fatima's body now and give her a funeral now. It will take place later.
Mm-hmm.
The people all returned home and thought that the funeral will take place in the morning,
right,
the next morning.
So how exactly did the funeral take place?
Well, they waited for it to get dark, and soon everybody fell asleep and no sounds were heard any longer. Imam Ali got up and went to do Fatima's ghusl. It's a wash and ablution that when a person dies, every person who dies needs to have this ghusl. Esma would give him the water and he did her ghusl and he did not remove her clothes, as this was one of her wishes before she died. She didn't want her clothes to be removed because she didn't want Imam Ali to see the bruises on her body, so that he could be upset that he was unable to defend his wife, that they could do this to his wife right under his nose. She didn't want him to be upset more than he already was. When the ghusl finished, Imam Ali covered her with a material that covered her whole body, and this was beneath the actual shroud. The reason Imam Ali did her ghusl, and because usually if it's a woman, women come and do her ghusl. If it's a man, men come and do her ghusl. The reason Imam Ali alayhi salam did her ghusl was firstly to honor her, and secondly because only an infallible can give an infallible a ghusl. A pure person who gives a pure person ghusl. That's how it is. Before Imam Ali sort of closed her shroud and covered her up, he called his children one by one to come and say their goodbyes. Now they came, Imam Hassan, Imam Hussein. They threw themselves on their mother, but they cried slowly because they didn't want people to hear. But they cried quietly because they didn't want people to hear. It's very difficult to try to hold back your tears.
To suppress your tears.
To suppress your tears. Imam Hassan and Imam Hussein, they threw themselves on their mother and they cried. And Imam Ali says, we have a saying from Imam Ali which he says, "As God is my witness, the daughter of the Prophet moaned and cried from beneath the material, and her hands came out and she held them," Imam Hassan and Hussein, "close to her chest. And the household of the Prophet could hear the angels' cries. One of these angels said, 'Oh Ali, pick them up, remove them from the body of Fatima. Remove them from their mother's body because they have made the angels of the skies cry. And the lover is eager to see his beloved.'" And so Imam Ali picked his children up from their mother's body. These children at such a young age had to lose their mother and suppress their hurt, their tears, and the loneliness they felt at that time. They had just lost the Prophet and now they had lost their mother. And their father has lost his khilafah. They had lost the respect between the people. People disrespected them. These children trying to handle such a situation is very, very difficult. Now, they then carried the body in silence to Fatima Zahra's grave. And only a handful of trustworthy people accompanied Imam Ali alayhi salam. Imam Ali alayhi salam then prayed on her body. And then they buried her. It is said that when they were gently putting Fatima Zahra's body in the grave, two hands that resembled the Prophet's hands came out and held her down. So the Prophet was taking back his amana. He gave this amana to the world. They treated her badly. He was taking her back. And Imam Ali said, "O earth, I give you my amana. Know that this is the daughter of the Prophet." They buried her and they made several other burial places so that the people would not know where the grave is.
In this way, they were able to bury her secretly in accordance with her wishes. In accordance with her wishes. Thank you very much. Mrs. Musawi, would you like have some final words you would like to say to our listeners before we go?
You should be proud we have Fatima Zahra in our life. You should hold it up as a medal. Fatima Zahra belongs to Islam, belongs to our Prophet. Read about her, speak of her. Her speeches are unknown to many. Read her speeches, read the interpretation. Make her your role model.
Thank you very much sharing with us about Hazrat Fatima Zahra. And we pray that we will emulate her in our lives so that we can achieve paradise. Thank you very much and goodbye from us.
Allahumma salli. على فاطمة وأبيها. اللهم صل على فاطمة وأبيها ودعيها
ودعيها
وبنيها
وبنيها
وبنيها بعدد ما أحاط به بعدد ما أحاط به علم بعدد ما أحاط به علم.
يوسف جلالي بتهران.
روبا شابت غازا.
جيروم هيوز بروسلز.
سعيد بورزا لندن.
راشا سغلام إسطنبول.
سيد أمين عالمي كابول.
شهانة بات Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Cinema Verite is the only festival in Iran that honors documentary filmmakers. The week-long cinematic event closed with an award ceremony in Tehran and prized the top documentaries of the year by filmmakers from Iran and the world. There's no limit for the themes of the entries. They can cover the sufferings of war-ravaged nations or deal with the socioeconomic impacts of the coronavirus. Among the films that received an award this year was Ali Reza Memariani's Broken Bones. The feature documentary narrates a bone-setter's concern about wildlife in Iran's southern Hormuz Island and his continuous effort to raise awareness of the critically endangered local deer that are falling victim to human intervention in their habitat. It's the 15th edition of Cinema Verite. Last year, it was held online due to the coronavirus pandemic. And this year, the films were screened both online and in theaters. 551 films were submitted to the Cinema Verite Secretariat, out of which 179 works were selected and put to contest. Foreign laureates were not present at the festival due to the pandemic, and their awards were handed to representatives from their country's embassies.
Documentaries must glue the audience to their seats with true yet touching stories instead of fiction, and with genuine scenes instead of visual effects. So docs that nab the Cinema Verite Award are definitely worth the top of the list of our must-watch films. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The spokesman for the Yemeni army, Yahya Sariya, says they have carried out another retaliatory attack against several targets in Saudi Arabia. He said the Yemen military struck aircraft hangars at the King Khalid Air Base in Nasir region and other sensitive targets in Jizan with 5 ballistic missiles.
This operation is part of the campaign to put pressure on the Saudi enemy because it only understands the language of force, and the silence of the international community encourages the Saudi regime to shed Yemeni's blood. We are carrying out military operations to make the Saudi regime understand that it must stop its airstrikes that are killing civilians all over the country. And we will continue to target Saudi facilities until the war stops.
Sariya said the attack came in response to the escalation of airstrikes by Saudi Arabia against Yemeni civilians. He vowed larger attacks unless Riyadh stops its ongoing war and siege.
These attacks come in the context of responding to the crimes of the Saudi enemy and the Saudi escalation in targeting civilians with air raids, whether in Sana'a or in other provinces. The Yemeni retaliatory attacks have penetrated the Saudi airspace and paralyzed the Saudi military. It is our right to respond to Saudi Arabia until the war and siege stop.
Recently, Saudi Arabia has been intensifying its airstrikes across Yemen and killing more civilians, including children. This has pushed the Yemeni army to launch further operations deep inside the kingdom.
Yemenis believe that the army has the right to hit back at those killing Yemeni women and the children and violating the sovereignty of their country. They say Riyadh should come to realize that the more attacks it conducts against Yemeni civilians, the more painful retaliatory strikes will be carried out against Saudi facilities. Abdul Latif Al Washali, Sana'a.
French President Emmanuel Macron didn't give a press conference until more than 2 years into his presidency, but he gave a 2-hour televised interview shortly after the publication of the first poll, which shows him losing in the second round of the April election. The primary of the mainstream Conservative Party recently selected Valérie Pécresse, a former budget minister under Nicolas Sarkozy. And a new poll has her beating Macron 52-48 in the final round.
Il faut avoir l'esprit que cette force politique...
The traditional conservatives are bouncing high in the polls, thanks to the buzz from being newly united around a single person. They've lost a lot of votes in 2017 due to their candidates' perceived corruption. But with a restructured party and message, the rumors of their total demise may have been premature.
In 2017, the Conservative candidate, François Fillon, was disgraced by a tremendous scandal over fake jobs, and yet he still almost made the second round. Many say the poll is a reminder of the historic strength of the mainstream Conservative Party, and also of Emmanuel Macron's almost permanently low approval ratings.
The one thing this poll makes clear is that Pécresse will at least be among the top three candidates of the first round. For her to advance, she really needs the support of Marine Le Pen to crumble, and also to attract many of Macron's dissatisfied voters, but it's too early to say if that will happen.
Pécresse hasn't come out of nowhere, but few expected that she would be in this position. She is often considered the conservative most similar to Macron, so a Pécresse-Macron final round won't offer many arguments in terms of policy. In the interview, Macron rejected his nickname, President of the Rich, but also promised that his re-election will bring right-wing changes to pensions that could cost him with older voters. He repeatedly admitted that he has made mistakes in his comportment, but not in his policies, and claimed that the corona pandemic made him more sensitive to the needs of the average person. Many said the interview appeared like a campaign speech, but Macron has still not yet declared if he is running for re-election. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Turkey's central bank voted to lower the interest rate of the country once again from 15% to 14%. This has directly affected the lira, which reached a record low of 15.5 right after the announcement. The Turkish lira has lost 50% of its value against the US dollar since the beginning of this year. In a trial to drag the attention of the public from the drop in lira value, Turkish president finally announced the raise in minimum wage after long negotiations between the government and opposition. Tayyip Erdogan said the increase would be 50%, making the minimum wage 4,253 Turkish lira.
The increase in minimum wage is 50%, the highest raise in the last 50 years. I believe that with this increase, we have shown our determination not to crush our employees in the face of price hikes.
Analysts refer to the public anti-government protests, saying people are complaining from the price hikes, the drop in lira value and inflation. However, instead of controlling the prices and solve the lira problem, the government chose to raise the minimum wage, which business owners are not very happy about, since they are already not meeting ends due to the economic situation in the country.
The increase in the minimum wage solves the problem just for right now. But if the inflation will keep staying higher like this, then in the long term, in a couple of months, the raise in the prices will eat the raise in the inflation and people will get poorer. Then it is for sure they will react against the AK Party in the elections. This may be the end of Erdogan era. What Erdogan hopes, they will not only increase their minimum wage, but they will also control the inflation. By more production, by more export, then they will also control the value of Turkish lira, then the inflation rate.
Investors and economists have been calling for the government to increase interest rates. However, it seems President Erdogan is sticking to his new plan, saying higher interest rates will worsen inflation. Analysts believe that the current economic crisis may put an end to Erdogan's era if he doesn't control the situation, especially now that both the ruling party and opposition are preparing for the elections. Rahşan Saglam, Istanbul.
Made in Iran.
This label is tagged on all of the 9,000 products showcased here in this exhibition that has the same title, Made in Iran. It's the 9th edition of the annual tech event that brings Iranian local producers under one roof in Tehran to promote their products. The products cover 14 industrial sectors, including oil and petrochemical industries, electricity, agriculture, and health. In addition to acting as an advertising platform for the participating companies, the expo is a hot marketplace where manufacturers can sell their products on the spot. In fact, it's a win-win deal for both customers and producers because any product is sold with as much as 50% discount funded by Iran's Vice Presidency for Science and Technology, with the aim of supporting domestic production. Since the U.S.'s withdrawal from the 2015 deal and reinstatement of sanctions on Iran in 2018, Tehran has doubled down on its efforts to wean its economy off the ups and downs of politics. While the new Iranian government still believes in diplomacy, it says it will not tie the economy to the 2015 deal, and instead, it lends more support to domestic production.
Domestic production, as put by local brands here, will be the key to a resilient economy in Iran and a counterforce to U.S. sanctions that prevent Iranian industries from accessing foreign technology. Now it seems that the sanctions have given domestic production a boost here as the government seeks to drive the economy with Made in Iran products. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Islamophobia is everywhere, making news on a regular basis. From the U.S.,
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States.
To the halls of power in Europe.
Do I have a problem with Islam? Yes, I do have a problem with Islam.
Recently, this made headlines. Lauren Boebert joking about meeting fellow Congressman Ilhan Omar.
I look to my left, and there she is. Oh. Ilhan Omar. And I said, well, she doesn't have a backpack. We should be fine.
Muslim minorities everywhere are discussing solutions to the crisis. At the Islamophobia Awareness Conference organized by the Islamic Human Rights Commission based in London, the panel asked how much Muslim minorities can engage with their non-Muslim governments without compromising their faith.
Is our position one where we should engage in a kind of pragmatic way to just the ends justify the means? Or rather, do we follow, for theological reasons, a principled approach?
I would say, from my perspective, it's vital for diasporas, Muslim diasporas, the Ummah across the world, African and Caribbean, you have to engage.
Muslims are often forced to pledge allegiance to Western values in an overtly violent way. This is an old and primary tool of all oppressors to keep the oppressed occupied with the master's concerns. So refusing to do this can be powerful.
The depoliticization of mosques and the younger generation is a major concern. Efforts to prevent young people seeking justice and fighting oppression have intensified, raising the alarm.
There is a deliberate attempt to social engineer a type of Muslim which will not speak out, will be just obedient servant, will fit into the second-class citizenship which we all know is being promoted.
We asked conference moderator Professor Saeed Khan why such events matter.
Conferences like this are ones that help to then map out what is then not only the condition of Muslims, but to try to then understand where and how we place resources and strategies moving forward.
The far right is growing across Europe, manifesting in anti-immigration policies, bans on the Islamic dress code, and encouraging anti-Islam sentiment via the media and digital spaces. So these discussions have to be had if stereotypes targeting Muslims are to be confronted and deconstructed. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Mohammed once again tops the list for the most popular boy's name for newborns in the UK. According to parenting website Baby Centre, the name of Islam's holy prophet was the most popular name for boys in 2021, meaning the beloved Muslim name has held the top spot for the fifth year in a row. Sadly, British Muslims are living in an era of growing Islamophobia, and simply having a Muslim-sounding name could inspire discrimination. However, despite this, the name remains as popular as ever, and it's growing year upon year.
So why do so many Muslim parents want to name their sons Mohammed? I asked a community leader to find out more.
When we pronounce the name of Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, it is a full of barakah. And if you see the meaning of Muhammad literally, it means the you can say praise again praise. Who, the person who is praised and whose praise is not coming to an end. So Muslims love their Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Hence they keep the name of their children Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. And also there is many reward. If a person has the name Muhammad, peace be upon him, in the day of, you can say, judgment, God will say, you will enter paradise. He is not only for the Muslim. He is the mercy for the mankind. He is the, you can say, light for each and everyone. So this is our duty. I would like to request to our, you can say, people, those they are not aware about it, they must study.
Baby Center said the name also tops the website's most popular boys' name for the entire decade, while other high-ranking baby names for boys and girls in 2021 with Muslim connections include Fatima, Ali, and Layla, further cementing the theory that Islam could become the most successful religion in the Western world in the not-too-distant future. Robert Carter, London.
Iran's 1979 Islamic Revolution is in its fifth decade. The revolution put an end to centuries of monarchy and established the Islamic Republic as the new political system in Iran. Now, as the country is preparing to mark the 42nd anniversary of the triumph of the revolution, military and state officials have gathered in Tehran to lay out the roadmap for the upcoming 40 years as part of a national plan called the Second Step of the Islamic Revolution.
From my point of view as a military commander, in the first 40 years of the revolution, Iran has taken greatest strides in the defense sector, moving from a mere consumer of foreign arms all the way to a producer of defense equipment. Now in the second phase of the revolution, we take it upon ourselves to turn into a military power by keeping abreast of the latest technologies.
2 years ago, and on the 40th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution, leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, issued a statement titled The Second Phase, or The Second Step of the Islamic Revolution, which is viewed as the beginning of a new chapter in the life of the Islamic Republic.
The statement issued by the leader was a strategic roadmap not only for the Iranian nation, but for all freedom seekers in the world. It is a set of guidelines that instruct us to promote Islamic ideals across the globe. In my opinion, the most important part of it is the emphasis on science and technology. The leader urged us to excel in this arena, as science builds power, and this is what we have gathered here for.
The Islamic Revolution promised independence from world powers and freedom for Iranians. To this end, the country has tried to achieve self-sufficiency in different sectors. Military officials say, despite 4 decades of an all-out sanctions regime imposed by the U.S. on Iran's defense sector, the country has managed to indigenize its arms arsenal and build all the necessary military equipment needed to defend its sovereignty. The country has also managed to step in other key sectors, including space, nanotechnology, and medication.
Iranian officials say the Islamic Republic has fulfilled its promise of independence from the West and self-reliance on domestic capacities in the first phase of the revolution. They say it is now more resilient in the face of political and economic pressures and is ready to achieve higher goals in the second phase of the Islamic Revolution. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Israeli media revealed a new settlement project being advanced by Israel's Justice Ministry in East Al-Quds that would eventually push Palestinians out of their homes in several areas of the Holy City. According to the reports, the ministry's so-called custodian of absentee property is promoting new settlements and settler housing units in Sheikh Jarrah, Damascus Gate, near Beit Safafa, in Sur Baher, and in Beit Hanina. The custodian of absentee property takes possession of Palestinian properties whose owners Israel considers to reside outside the Palestinian territories, regardless of the fact that Palestinian families live in these homes since 1948 as tenants because they are not the original owners.
Israel continues to seize Palestinian properties under the so-called absentee law.
It demolishes Palestinians' homes and properties. All this comes under the policy of ethnic cleansing and forcing Palestinians out of the holy city. It's part of their larger plan to achieve the dream of greater Al-Quds. But our people insist on their struggle and remain adherent to their inalienable rights.
Anti-settlement groups say if Israel succeeds in implementing the move, this will definitely entail the eviction of Palestinian residents, repeating the same scenario of the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood. The groups accuse the Israeli regime of insisting on pushing Palestinians out of the holy city, regardless of the consequences. They also inquire why the Israeli regime refuses to return these homes to their real owners instead of bringing in new settlers and expanding settlements.
If this is an absentee law, return back these people to their original houses, which is still there, still in the old city, still occupied by other Israeli settlers, Jews. So there is no justice in this, and this is like clearly this is in a kind of an occupation laws that they are targeting the indigenous and the people of the city.
Today, there are about 500,000 Israeli settlers living in the occupied West Bank, with almost 250,000 more living in Al-Quds settlements, which are considered in violation of international law.
Palestinians angrily wonder how the Israeli laws allow the Jewish settlers to take over their properties under numerous claims. But at the same time, this right is denied to the real owners, the Palestinians, who have been forced out of their assets in 1948, ever since Israel's establishment. Muna Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
EU Foreign Affairs Ministers gathered in Brussels on Monday for their final scheduled meeting of 2021. They accuse Moscow of massing troops near Ukraine's border in preparation for a possible invasion.
The ministers, all of them, have been very clear today that any aggression against Ukraine will come with political consequences and with a high economic cost for Russia.
Moscow denies it intends to invade Ukraine and accuses Kiev of Western-backed provocation. Many analysts say the EU's undying support for Ukraine is nothing short of scandalous. Just last September, the European Court of Auditors, the 27-nation bloc's financial watchdog, published a report showing that corruption in Ukraine is rife at the highest levels amongst politicians, the judiciary and state-owned enterprises. The report states that since 2014, EU taxpayers have sent 12.5 billion euro to Kiev via the European Commission, but corruption reform efforts have failed. New sanctions against Russia being considered by the EU include travel bans and asset freezes targeting politicians. The Federation's banking sector could be hit. Perhaps the new gas pipeline between Russia and Germany might be blocked from becoming operational. The Kremlin has warned against further provocation. Despite all the rhetoric, analysts point out that the EU and Russia are major trading partners, particularly in the area of energy.
I think that very existence of this strong economic interconnectivity is encouraging to look for the ways for the better political relations.
Those relations are currently at an all-time low and will be the subject of much debate when EU leaders hold a summit here in the Belgian capital. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hussain Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Shiraz Agha. Thank you for joining us here today. Today on The Key, we want to be examining a question that sometimes pops up in the minds of people. And that question is related to the title of Ahlul Bayt, the family of the Prophet. We know that this title is mentioned in the hadith of the cloak, And in the Hadith of the Cloak, the Hadith of Kisa, we see that five individuals were present, and they were given this title of Ahlul Bayt, or referred to by the title of Ahlul Bayt. These were the Prophet ﷺ, the Lady Fatima, her husband Imam Ali, Imam Hassan, and Imam Hussein alayhim as-salam. At the same time, we know that we refer to all of the Imams as being of the family of the Prophet, the Ahlul Bayt. These two matters seem to contradict one another, or we could say that if those five individuals are family, the family belong to the family of the Prophet and have been referred to as family of the Prophet, how can all of the Imams be referred to in the same way and with the same title? And this then is the question. The response to this question can be given in numerous ways. We looked at some of those ways in the previous sessions. Today we want to be answering this from another point of view, and that's this, that at the time when this verse was revealed, the verse of purification, Ayat Tathir, which is also mentioned in the verse of and also mentioned in the Hadith of the Cloak, those five individuals mentioned in the Hadith of the Cloak were the only people who this title could be given to. In other words, the other Imams alayhi wasalam had yet to be born, right? So if in this tradition, if there's any indication that this title is limited to these individuals, it's not because the other Imams are not deserving of this title, but it's only simply because at that time and in the era in which this verse was revealed, these were the only individuals who were present there and who were present and existing and living at that time. Therefore, this doesn't contradict the fact that if later on other Imams were born from the progeny of the Prophet, they could also be deserving of this title, and this title could also be predicated and be used with respect to them. Another way that we can answer this question is this, by saying that all of them are extensions. Their existence is an extension of the existence of the Prophet. All of them are a single light. This is something that is a very basic tenet of the Shiite creed. And therefore, if one of them or if some of them are belong to the family of the Prophet, this doesn't contradict the fact that the others also belong to the family of the Prophet, and this title cannot be used with respect to them. In this respect, it's interesting to mention a tradition which is also related to the event of Karbala. And that's that when the captives from the Battle of Karbala, including the fourth Imam, Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, were being brought and paraded in the streets of Syria and Damascus, a certain individual came to the fourth Imam, an old man, and asked him to what tribe he belonged. In response to this, the Imam replied, "Have you read the Quran?" The person said, "Yes." He said, "Have you read this verse of the Holy Quran?" And he recited the famous verse of purification, "Innama yuridu Allah layuthiba ankum ritsa ahla al-bayt wa yutahhirakum tathira." He said, the Imam then said that this verse is a reference to our tribe, the tribe of the family of the Holy Prophet. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at the Ahlul Bayt and its capability of being applied to all of the Imams alayhi wasalam. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
This is IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
In the limelight.
Biden has been revealed in this oil lease fiasco as yet another lying politician willing to eat dirt for the fossil fuel industry, says William Rivers Pitt, journalist, in an article titled, "Despite his promises, Biden is still serving fossil fuel interests." Stay tuned for more. November's COP26 International Environmental Summit in Glasgow was an unsurprising disappointment on pretty much every level. A bunch of world leaders beholden to the global energy industry came together in the rain to pretend they were making progress on the existential threats hovering over us all, but the act wore thin in a hurry. An environmental summit whose participants cannot summon the will to admit that burning coal is bad for the air and water is an environmental summit that should have stayed in bed. Adding insult to injury, the Biden administration held a massive lease sale for oil and gas drilling rights in the Gulf of Mexico scant days after the conclusion of the summit. Some 80 million acres of seafloor, which could contain more than a billion barrels of oil and more than 4 trillion cubic feet of natural gas, were up for grabs. According to an analysis by the Center for American Progress, the offshore lease sale alone has the potential to emit 723 million metric tons of CO2 into the atmosphere over its lifetime, equivalent to operating more than 70% of the United States coal-fired power plants for a year. As if this were not bad enough, there is the timeline. The companies that bought leases to drill in Gulf of Mexico, Exxon and BP, stand tall in the crowd. We'll need years to install the infrastructure required to get to the oil and gas. This means the actual extraction and burning of these fossil fuels will not even begin until around 2030. A year many climate scientists have set as a hard deadline for reversing course on our ecological dissolution. The whole thing felt like a deliberate finger in the eye of the environmental movement by the Biden administration, but the president and his people begged for understanding. "The courts are making us do this," they claimed. "We paused all new leasing a year ago, but got slapped by an injunction that required us to do the auction. It is out of our hands." We are required to comply with the injunction, Press Secretary Jen Psaki said in November as all this was unfolding, adding, it's a legal case and legal process, but it's important for advocates and other people out there who are following this to understand that it's not aligned with our view, the president's policies, or the executive order that he signed. The Guardian reports the Biden administration admitted that a court decision did not compel it to lease the vast tracts of the Gulf of Mexico for oil and gas drilling, shortly before claiming it was legally obliged to do so when announcing the sale of The Guardian can reveal. The president's administration insisted it was obliged to hold the lease sale due to a court ruling in favor of a dozen states that sued to lift a blanket pause placed on new drilling permits by Biden. But a memo filed by the U.S. Department of Justice before the lease sale acknowledges that this judgment does not force the government to auction off drilling rights to the Gulf. The administration has been misleading on this. To put it mildly, it's very disappointing, said Thomas Mayer, National Organizing Manager of Food and Water Watch, adding, they didn't have to hold this sale, and they didn't have to hold it on this timeline. We know this will exacerbate the climate crisis. It undermines U.S. credibility abroad, and it contradicts a campaign promise by Biden. The urgent need to address anthropogenic climate disruption becomes more evident by the day. A massive Antarctic ice shelf called the Waits is maybe 5 years away from shattering, according to newly released data. Total collapse of the Waits could result in several feet of sea level rise, reports the Washington Post, endangering millions of people in coastal areas. A historically hot summer in the Pacific Northwest is responsible for the heat-related death of as many as billion sea creatures. Many other species have also been impacted, including humans. These so-called heat domes have been followed by long stretches of warm, dry weather that has virtually erased the snowpack high in the western mountains. Without enough snowfall, drought and fire are all but guaranteed to follow. Only days ago, tornadoes tore through 9 states, including Kentucky, in the middle of the night, causing unimaginable damage and sparking a debate as to the relationship of the climate crisis to the monster storm. A variety of factors are involved in the formation of tornadoes, making it difficult to pinpoint casualty. Yet the sheer size of the storm, combined with the timing, tornadoes of any size in December are extremely rare, make it hard to claim that climate had nothing to do with it. While he's no Donald Trump, Biden has been revealed in this oil lease fiasco as yet another lying politician willing to eat dirt for the fossil fuel industry. Trump would have done these things and then claimed he didn't, but would have said that even if he had done them, which he didn't, they were the right things to do. Biden just does them and moves on down the line. The president has broken the first rule of birds. The trouble is, this nest belongs to all of people around the world, and we are well and truly screwed without it.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, thank you so very much for joining us on today's episode of The Lantern. As always, it's a genuine pleasure and an absolute honor to be with you guys and to have a share in your precious and valuable time. And I am ever so grateful that you guys take time out of your day to hopefully join in our little discussions that we have, these little reminders. Nothing new, really. I am in no place to educate anyone, nor do I have any sort of knowledge that could be an additional contribution to what our listeners already have. But let's think of them as reminders. As reminders, and as the show's name very fittingly indicates, as little lanterns, little lights here and there that show us the way, that guide us toward the bewilderment of life. Speaking about life, life is simple yet complicated at the same time. I feel that anyone above the age of 25 would understand this with every iota of their existence, that life can be simple. It has a set of general rules. It has this holistic blueprint, and which consists of this overall guidelines and principles and rules. And this fundamental, this basic blueprint of life is constant. It's what is referred to in the Quran, I suppose, as Sabghatullah, or the Sunnah of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, or whatever name anyone wants to give it, whether it's the universe or the force of nature. And then there are moments and little details that come into play that get involved and somehow make life complicated. Let's listen to a short little anecdote. I will be right back.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, especially this program Lantern, so welcome. As usual, we have an interesting story at the beginning of the program. A great Japanese warrior named Nobunaga was going to war with the enemy with only 1/10 the number of men the opposition commanded. He knew that he could win the fight with a well-planned strategy, but his soldiers were in doubt. On the day, the leader stopped at the Shinto shrine and told his men, "After my visit to the shrine, I will toss a coin. If the head comes, we will win. If tails, we will lose. Destiny holds us in her hand." Nobunaga entered the shrine and offered his prayers. Then he came forth and tossed a coin. In front of his men, heads appeared. The soldiers were filled with confidence and were eager to win the battle. "No one can change the hand of destiny," one of his attendants told him after the battle. "Indeed not," said Nobunaga, and showed a coin which was doubled with heads on the both sides. "The only person you are destined to become is the person you decide to be." That was a famous quote by Ralph Waldo Emerson. ¶¶
the lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
Basically, if I wanted to bridge between the little speech I had before the story with the story itself, the short anecdote that we heard, I'd have to say that what I meant to convey is that there's this concept within religion, or really any sort of a worldview. It might have different names again, but what we refer to in Islam and what the Ahlul Bayt and the Holy Quran have taught us is qada and qadar, right? And the concept of jabr and ikhtiyar, whether it's compulsion or whether it's free will. And a beautiful hadith from one of our beautiful imams really clarifies this to an extent, yet the clarification hadith, the explanation itself, needs a whole lot of explanation, as are the words of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. They have butun to them, you know, they have depths, they have layers. The Imam says, Amrun bayn al amrain. It's something between the two. It's like a cross between compulsion and free will. It is a mix between destiny and what we make of life. It is preordained and it is seize the moment. It is fate. And it is my own choice at the same time. The fate part comes in. So this is how it works, basically, from my understanding and my 20-something years of experience on God's green earth. Yes, I have free will, but the effects, the consequences of my choice is preordained. Right? In the case of our story, the ruler made a choice to go to war with an army that outnumbered his. The ruler also made a choice his entire life to be a really good ruler. And he also probably made a choice during his rule to train his, albeit small, army in the best way he could and teach them all the arts of war and battle and self-defense and this and that. And he must have trained them well enough to be able to demand that degree of submission from them, even though they knew they were going to a battle that they were going to face an army that outnumbered them. They did it anyway, you know, to follow and obey the commands of their ruler. All of these are a sequence of choices, but which all have a set concrete, constant consequence. It's how it's always been. It's how it always will be. And when the ruler flipped the coin, he furthermore determined the fate of himself and his army by making the choice of only focusing on the option of winning, only focusing on courage, only focusing on positive outcome. For him, it was, we're either going to win or we're going to win. That's it. There's no other options on the table. Thus, there could be no other outcomes. That's all the time we have for today's episode of The Lantern. Thank you for being with us. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah. Ana bi dhikrillahi tatma'innul qulub.